Because you know, we've been learning a great deal, haven't we, about love from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And as we come today to the end of that passage, Paul tells us something that is really very important for us to know. Because he writes about the future kingdom in the new heaven and the new earth. And he tells us what it is. And then he even hints at what it will be like. So what we aim to do is to have a look, just a glimpse, at what the future has in store for us. And once we've identified those things, we'll draw out some applications and highlight the difference that it should make to the way that we live our lives right now. Now, in telling us what the future kingdom will be like, Paul gives us three metaphors. He calls it the perfect. He calls it the face. And he calls it love. The perfect, the face, and love. So let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And we'll read verse 9, and we'll read it in the New King James Version. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 9. And here Paul says, "For we know in part, and we prophesy in part." So he's talking about now versus later. Time versus eternity. And he says, "For now we know and we prophesy in part, but," verse 10, "when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away." Now in the NIV it says, "when completeness comes." And the Greek word that Paul uses here is the word teleion. And it has the meaning design, or the aim, or the end purpose. When all is complete, when all is perfect. So Paul is talking about when we get to that for which we are aiming for. He's talking about the ultimate fulfillment of design. All that we were meant to be. All that we should be. All that we were made to be. All that we would want to be. There's that place that we are headed for. It's the place that we're all yearning for, actually. Now, to give you an idea about this, just think for a moment of a beached whale. Now, is a beached whale alive? Well, yes, it is, but not for very long. It's actually dying. It may be moving around. Actually, it's swimming, because the whale's reflexes are to swim. And so the whale flops about, flops its tail, but all it does is kick up sand. And the reason why it does that is because it's not in its element. It's not in its teleion. It's not in the water for which it's designed. And in effect, Paul is saying to each one of us, we are like beached whales. Our souls are out of the water. We're dying. We only die. We only fall apart when we're not in our teleion. Where we're not where we were built to be. And not only that, we have reflexes in us for which we can find no satisfaction. Because all of us want unconditional love, the very thing that we've been talking about over these past weeks. We want unconditional love, but there is no such thing. There are things in us to which in this world there is no correspondent reality. And now why is that? Well, Paul says it's because you're not in your element. But he's saying there is a place, there is a condition, where you do become all that you were supposed to be. Where your potential is going to be fully realized. It's the perfect. It's the teleion. It's your element. That's the first thing that he's telling us here. Now the second thing that he tells us about this place, this condition, is that it is seeing a face. It is seeing a face. In verse 12, it says, "For now we see in a mirror dimly." But then, you see, when we've reached our teleon, then face to face. We've been singing about that in some of the songs, haven't we? Face to face. "Now I know in part," he says, "but then I shall know just also as I am known." Now what is this face that we're going to see? The face for which we are built for. The face which is the water for our beached souls. The face that we have to have or we'll die. What is it? Well, do you know how you know? Well, you have to look at the last part of verse 12. Notice it doesn't say there, when I get to eternity, when I get to heaven, I shall know and I shall be fully known. Now, he doesn't say that, does he here? He doesn't say, I shall know and I shall be known. Rather, he says, I shall know just as I also am known. You see, the "am" here is in the present tense. He will know someone and he will see someone face to face who right now knows him fully. And there's only one person who knows you fully. In other words, this is the beatific vision. This is the face of God. Paul says that is what he is waiting for. This is the water for our beached souls. This is what we have to have in order to live. Now notice how the psalmist expressed this in Psalm chapter 80 and verse 3. Psalm chapter 80 and verse 3. And the psalmist says this, "Restore us, O God. Restore us. We're dying. We're like a whale on the beach that's dying." And the psalmist is crying out, "Restore us." How can we be restored? Cause your face to shine. Cause your face to shine on us. And we shall be saved. Now, how is that possible? Well, the Apostle John gives us a clue in the very prologue of his Gospel. John chapter 1, and beginning in verse 1. The most theological of all of the Gospels. And John is trying to get us to understand the very nature of God, who God is, and who Christ is in relation to God. John chapter 1, and in verse 1, he writes, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." He was in the beginning with God. So John tells us here that the Logos was with God. And the word that he uses is the preposition pro. And what that means is towards. And so what John is telling us here is that the Word was towards God. In other words, the Logos was face to face with God. Here is the solution to mankind's dilemma. Because even though we have turned our face away from God, and we've hid ourselves from him, Jesus Christ came to undo Adam's sin and to reconcile us to the Father. And through his vicarious life and death and resurrection and ascension, this last Adam has taken humanity into himself and restored us to a face-to-face position, a relationship with the Father. This is the gospel message. This is why John starts his gospel with this. Because this is the heart of the gospel. This is what you and I need. This is what you and I want. whether we recognize it or not. This is the reason why we come to Jesus, so that we can be face to face with the Father. But that's not all. There's a third thing that Paul tells us about this future kingdom. Yes, we're going to be in our element. Yes, we're going to be face to face with the Father. And then we come to the very last word of chapter 13. And it's the word love. Agape. And it's not just the last word because that's a rather neat way to end the chapter. But it's the last word because it is the last word. Go back to 1 Corinthians 13. Because Paul has the audacity here to say that right now, temporarily, we have this. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 13. And now, right now, abide faith, hope, love. These three abide now. But the greatest of these, he says, is love. Three things, faith, hope, and love. But you know, even faith and hope are just scaffolding. That's all they are. Even faith and hope are unnecessary in the end. Even faith and hope are not intrinsic to who God is. Even faith and hope are not what eternity is about. It's all about love. All about love. The experience of seeing God face to face is an experience of entering into and participating in that divine circle, that divine dance of love. That's what life is all about. That is where we are heading. And by the way, this is really so important for us to grasp. Because the Eastern religions, the mystical philosophies, they do believe in eternity. And they believe that there will be an end to all of our suffering. But in their understanding, when you die, you go off into eternity. You lose your individual consciousness. You lose your sense of personhood, you lose your sense of being a self, and you move out into the collective universe, and in reality you just become one with everything else. And as a result, say, your tears are wiped away, all suffering ends, and you are all in all. Of course, the meaning for that type of religion is that eternity is just full of peace and serenity. But you know, that's not the vision of Paul, and it's not the vision of the Bible. In fact, I'd go as far as to say that's not really what our heart desires. It's not what the human heart really wants. And Paul here doesn't say faith, hope, and peace and serenity, but the greatest of these is peace and serenity. He says faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. See, what the human heart really craves, what it really desires, is not to lose our individuality. Human beings don't want to be lost. They want to be embraced. And the coming kingdom of God is a world of love. We want to be taken in. We don't want to be lost in eternity. We want to be found. C.S. Lewis says, glory means acceptance by God, acknowledgement and welcome into the very heart of things. The door on which we have been knocking all of our lives will be open at last, and we will be called in, and we will be received. See, we don't lose ourselves in eternity, we find ourselves. And Paul says in verse 12, for now we see in a mirror dimly. We see in a rather confused way. And by the way, mirrors in those days were just polished metal. And so when you looked into them, they always gave you a distorted image of yourself. So when it says dimly or darkly, it's talking about that rather confused reflection, a rather poor reflection that we see of ourselves. The actual word that Paul uses here is the word from which we get our English word, enigma. Enigma. You see, what Paul is telling us is we are riddles to ourselves. We don't really know who we are. And the future of the Christian is not one where you empty yourself. It's not one where you lose yourself. It's the place where you finally find out who you are. And we find out who God truly is. And that God not only has a face, but that we have a face too. And we will be face to face. The future kingdom will be a time when we are fully known and fully loved. We will be embraced. We will dance with God. He will sweep us off of our feet. And he will say, do you know, you look so beautiful today. And we will say, so do you. See, this is the uttermost. This is the perfect destination. Let me just give you a few implications of what it will be like. And then we'll go on to the application. Because what you believe about the coming kingdom has got to make all the difference to you and me now and how we live our lives. It's got to make all the difference to the way we live in this world. You see, the truth of the matter is, the people who are the most heavenly minded, if you understand what that means, will be the most earthly good. You will be. Now, Paul gives us a couple of incredible hints about what that world is like. There are two main things here. Here's the first. Everything stops but love. Prophecies stop. Power stops. But what's interesting, faith and hope stop. He says that these three things are here right now, but the greatest is love. You see, take a look at verse 7. Love always trusts, always hopes. You see what Paul is doing? He's saying that faith and hope ultimately are just means to an end. Faith and hope are just outworkings. Everything is to love. And do you know why? Faith and hope are not intrinsic to God, but love is. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8 simply says, God is love. That's who God is. It's repeated again in verse 16. Now, here's the implication of that. If God were unipersonal, if he was just one being, one person, then love would not be intrinsic to him. Because he would not have been able to love until he created someone to love. In fact, he wouldn't have been able to love at all. Just think about the definition of love that we've been talking about as we've gone through this chapter. You know, you feel love when somebody is delighted in you for who you are. Not for what you bring to them, but for who you are. You see, when you feel that people are using you to get something, loving you conditionally, as long as you are bringing them something that they want and that they need, well, you're not being loved by that person, you're actually being used by them. You're only loved when they're delighted in you for who you are. But you see, if God had needed us in order to have a relationship, in order to love, then we wouldn't have been loved by him, we would have been used by him. Do you see the logic of that? He would have created us simply to abuse us. But that's not the case, because God is not unipersonal. He's tripersonal. He's triune. Father, Son, and Spirit have for all eternity been in a loving relationship with each other. You see, if there had just been one other person to love, then it wouldn't have been proper love. It would have just been a selfish love that excluded anybody else. But with three divine persons, mutually penetrated by love. It was something that was shared and was inclusive. And you see, that is what's at the very centre and at the very heart of the universe. This is what's at the very middle of the universe. This is the infinite, essential love of God. It's an eternal, mutual, holy energy between Father, Son, and Spirit. They delight in each other. And from all eternity past, that is what they have been doing, pouring into one another, into themselves, their love and their joy and their delight. That's who God is. So then why were we created? Why were we reconciled when we were fallen? Well, you know, Jesus explains it for us in one of the most incredible passages in John's Gospel. John chapter 17. We'll look at this in the NIV. John 17. Remember, John is trying to explain to us who God is and how Jesus relates to God. And therefore, how do we fit in? John 17 and verse 20. Jesus says here, "My prayer is not for them alone, not just for the disciples alone. I pray for those who will believe in me through their message." So he's praying for you and me. That's us, isn't it? We believe because we've heard the message of the disciples recorded for us in Scripture. "That all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity." This is the teleion. This is the completeness that Paul is talking about. That we can be brought to this position. "Then the world will know that you sent me and I have loved them even as you have loved me. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory. The glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world." You see, love was there. Before the creation of the world, it's eternal. Now, what does all that mean? Well, it means that Jesus is praying. And he's praying, "I want them to see my glory. I want them in the love with us. I want them to be included in the circle that we've had throughout all eternity. I want them to become a part of this divine dance. I want them to have the same love that you and I, Father, have had for all eternity. I want them to be with us." See, this is really getting to the heart of everything. It's getting to the heart of the universe. This is getting to the very heart of God. The ultimate glory of God is this incredible love between the Father, Son, and Spirit. And Jesus wants you and me included in that love. We were once lost, but now we're found. We've now been reconciled. We've now been brought home to be a part of that love. You know, this is the love song of which all other love songs are merely just hints and echoes. This is the song. This is the drama. This is the love story. This is the dance, the marriage, the friendship. This is the family. And we are brought into the very center of it. You see, have you ever got joy out of a song? Have you got joy out of your marriage? You ever got joy out of a dance or out of friendship? Where does the joy in those things come from? Well, you see, it's derivative. All of those things are just like the moon. But the love of God is the sun from which all of those things reflect his glory and in which he has his being. And you and I are asked to come and be right at the very center of his being of love. That is your element. That is your teleion. That's your completeness and your perfection. Isn't that true? To just anticipate what that future will be like. Now there's one other hint about what's the future going to be like, what the kingdom will be like. And that's where Paul says, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 12. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 12, he says, I shall know just as I also am known. What is it that Paul fully knows? Well, you see, the word know means a relationship. You see, when the old King James Version says Adam knew Eve, it was referring to their relationship. And so here Paul is talking about a relationship that he and we have with God because we are fully loved and we are utterly and completely known by God and accepted by him. We are holy and blameless in God's sight. We are adopted into the very family of God and we are fully known. You see, the trouble is we don't fully know our knownness. You see, if I knew that I was fully known, I'd never be bored again. I'd never have self-pity again. I'd never be angry in the wrong sense again. I'd never be resentful. I'd never be anxious about things. I'd never be afraid. I'd never be impatient. I'd never sin. But you know, I've got a problem. I've got a problem. Let me give you an example. If a woman has just £200 to her name, and she lends that £200 to somebody else, she's going to be nervous the whole time. And if that person doesn't pay her back, she's going to freak out. That's all the money she's got in the world. But what if a woman who had millions of pounds lends somebody £200? Well, she'll do that with a certain amount of peace. Now, if the person doesn't pay her back, she can be fairly patient about that. She can be fairly forgiving, fairly kind to that person. After all, she's got millions of pounds in the bank. If the rich woman starts to freak out because that £200 hasn't been paid back, then all she has to do is to remember who she is and what she's got. Now the problem that I have, and maybe you have this problem too, is that I forget what I have spiritually. I forget it. Have you ever done something for somebody and they haven't paid you back? Have you loved somebody without it being returned? Have people hurt you or wronged you? Are things going wrong in your life? Do you freak out when those things happen? Because those things do happen, don't they? How do we respond? Do we freak out about those things? Do you know why you're freaking out? It's because you don't remember who you are. That's the reason. You don't remember what you have in Christ. You don't remember that. You're fully known and you don't know that you are fully known. But in the kingdom, that very first moment in the kingdom, we will know. The minute we will know, it will inflict a glory on us that will never ever go out. And that glory will be absolutely beautiful. Have you ever noticed that when you're in love with someone, you want them to be beautiful? But Jesus loves you. Incredibly loves me. And we're told in Ephesians 5 that he's our husband. And he's going to spend all of eternity adorning us. Imagine that. All of eternity adorning us. Making us look more and more beautiful. And have you ever noticed that when you fall in love with somebody, you don't want to be independent any longer. You can't give yourself over to love and keep your independence. It's just impossible. Love by nature says, I want to be owned and I want to own. I want to surrender and I want to be surrendered to. I want to utterly lose my freedom, and I want you to lose your freedom to me. Now, see, that's what love always wants. But the trouble is, in this world, that if you do that because of sin, because of the fallen nature that mankind has, if you're not careful, you can be exploited in that type of situation, but not in the kingdom of God. Not in God's kingdom, because we're told the very essence of covenant is God saying, you will be my people and I will be yours. You see the very nature of the relationship? You're going to be mine and I am going to be yours. We will own each other. And here's the most amazing thing. As we are in one another and in God, the more we will know who we are, and the more we will know each other, and the more we will know God. C.S. Lewis put it like this. He told the situation of three friends that got together a lot. There was Lewis himself, and there was J.R.R. Tolkien, who they knew was Ronald, and another chap called Charles Williams. And they were buddies, and they would go to the pub together, and they would, you know, have a pint of beer together and talk and reminisce and share ideas. They had this sort of relationship. But Lewis said he found something rather odd. Because when Charles died, he didn't get more of Ronald. He got less of him. And he said this, I suddenly realized that I didn't just lose Charles to get more of Ronald, but I lost the part of Ronald that only Charles brought out that I couldn't bring out. I could never get that part of Ronald that came only when Charles told one of his jokes, for example. And he continued, I began to realize that the way that you get to know any person is not by having them to yourself, but by sharing them with other people who they love and who love them. I began to realize that no one human being is big enough to call out the entire person into activity and draw them out. Now here's what's so incredible. Only as we are loving God together will we find that we know who He is and see His beauty. Because all of us will be drawing something out for the rest of us. Only as we are loving all of Him and seeing Him in all of His fullness will we find out who the people are around us. So Lewis concluded, in this way, friendship exhibits a glorious resemblance to heaven, where the very multitude of the blessed increases the fruition that each of us has of God. For every soul, seeing Him in his or her own way, doubtless communicates that uniqueness to the rest of us. And he says, that's why in Isaiah 6 and verse 3, if you look, you'll see all of the angels calling out, holy, holy, holy to each other. Come and see God the way I see. No, have a look how I see Him. It brings out the fullness of God. See, finally we have what we want. Finally, without sin, we will see that the more that we give each other away, the more we have of each other. The more we give ourselves to God, the more we have of Him. Because that's how God works. You know, God gave Himself away completely so that we could have more of Him. That's the way it works. You see, isn't this a wonderful and an inspiring future? But the question is, isn't it? The question is, what difference should that make to me right now? What difference should all of that future mean to the way that I live now? You know, if the future is going to be a world of love, how should that affect our lives today and tomorrow and in the weeks and months ahead? Well, let me just highlight a few areas for us. First of all, if the future kingdom is a world of love, then that means that ultimate reality is personal. Ultimate reality is about relationships. You see, if there was no future after this life, if when we die we just rot, then reality is fundamentally impersonal. You know, that's the case for people who don't believe in God, who don't believe in an afterlife. See, whether they know it or not, reality for them is fundamentally impersonal. You see, a human being lasts, 70 or 80 years and then is gone. Civilizations may last for thousands of years and then they disappear. A fortune might last for a long time, but then it's gone. Cultural institutions last for a long time and then they're gone. Eventually, see, it all goes. And in that sort of position, people will sometimes feel, well, it's okay for me then to tread on someone else's rights. It's all right for me to tread over somebody else's life in order for me to get a better civilization or to make more money. Let me tread all over you so that I can gain more money. But you see, for a Christian who knows that a person and relationships are always going to be more important than just making a fast buck. A Christian knows that if there's any conflict between a business goal or achieving some ambition and the human being and the relationship that we have with one another, then the person always has to win. Always. Because you see, if the future kingdom is a world of love, then we will know that it is the person that is infinitely important. You see, who cares how long civilizations last? You see, compared to the person, anything else here is just like the life of a mosquito. Here today and gone tomorrow. A Christian is to become a radically personal person. And it has to affect every facet of our life. It has to affect our family. How do we respond and relate to our family? It has to affect our business practices. It has to affect our politics. What's most important in our politics? Just look at the American debates going on in the Senate. What's most important? It actually affects how you deal with someone in the checkout queue at Tesco's. How are you going to deal with the person in the checkout queue? It actually affects the other drivers on the road. It affects everything. Let me give you a second area. If the future kingdom is a kingdom of love, then you can begin to see that if you have any unreconciled relationships, then your relationship with God, your sense of the reality of the kingdom and your assurance of salvation, your sense of God's love and God's presence are going to be taken away. Because you see, you're breaking a relationship which is at the very heart of the universe. See, when you're bitter and when you're angry with someone, when you just can't talk to that person, you just want nothing to do with them, it's going to affect your spiritual access to God. It is. Look at Matthew chapter 5. And we'll read this in the message. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 21. And Jesus says here, look, you're familiar with the command to the ancients. Do not murder. I'm telling you that anyone who is so much as angry with a brother or sister is guilty of murder. Just being angry with a brother or sister. Carelessly call a brother an idiot, and you just might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister, and you're on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill. Verse 23. This is how I want you to consider yourself in these matters. If you enter your place of worship and you're about to make an offering and you suddenly remember a grudge a friend has against you, abandon your offering and leave immediately. Don't continue with the worship. It's a waste of time. You might as well be out down Camberwell New Road doing your shopping. What's the point? Leave immediately. Go to this friend and make things right. Then, and only then, come back and work things out with God. In other words, if you don't do that, Don't bother coming back to try and worship God. That's what he's saying. Do you see why unreconciled relationships destroy your assurance and destroy your spiritual access to God? Because the kingdom is a world of love. It's a world of relationships. Let me give you a couple more. If the future kingdom is a world of love, we should be people of passion. You know, both the Eastern religions and secular therapists really are basically Stoics. And Stoicism says, look, the way that you'll be happy is to really whittle down all of your desires. And they'll basically tell you, look, your real problem is you want too much. Stop asking for the moon. Stop reaching for the stars. This is life. You're only going to get so much love. You're only going to get so much glory. Whittle down your desires. Realize there's only so much you're going to be able to get. So just accept that and grow up. But you know, Christianity tells us exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. God says, look at money. Look at success. Look at romance. Look at your family. Look at marriage. They're all nice things. But they're not your home. They're not your teleon. That's not the end purpose. Don't try and make those things your satisfaction. Don't have your passion in those things. Your soul is too great and too big for those things. You have the most extraordinary future ahead of you. Be passionate about that. Don't whittle down your desires. Rather, fan the flame of passion because the best is yet to be. Now here's another one. If the future kingdom is a world of love, it means that we can face suffering now. Now I've mentioned this before, but Teresa of Avila once said, the first second in heaven will be a consolation for the worst life on earth. The worst life on earth from heaven will look like one night in a bad hotel. That's what it will look like. And you know, you can live that way. We can live in the way that whatever happens here and now is just like one bad night in a hotel compared to the whole of eternity of love that we're going to have with God. That's all it is, just one bad night. See, if the kingdom is a world of love, Christians can be incredible fighters here. And the reason why is because this knowledge of the future means we won't treat this earth and the things of this earth is the most important. You see, only a secularist, only a humanist, only if you're just an atheist, with no concept of the world to come, will you believe that what happens here is the most important. You see, if the future kingdom, this world of love, it means that people matter and are more important. And the future with God is more important. And because people matter, if you see an injustice in the neighbourhood, if you see disunity and dishonesty in the office, if you see cruelty in the family, you'll speak up because people matter. They are more important than property. They are more important than your job. They are more important than the money you've got in your bank account. And so you'll fight for people. You'll fight for their safety. You'll fight for their well-being in every regard. That's why we should be concerned for people. That's why I'm glad it was mentioned in the prayers today for the people that are suffering in this world. If you know the kingdom is a world of love, you'll be prepared to make a sacrifice, to lose something for the benefit of other people. You see, what possibly in this world could you lose that really matters in the long run? You know, there's a courage that comes to anyone who knows that there is a future world of love. Remember the words of Jesus, and again, I think these have been mentioned already today. John chapter 14. John 14 and verse 1, Jesus says, don't let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms, and if that were not so, I would have told you that I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'm going to come back. And when I come back, I'm going to take you to be with me, so that you'll be wherever I am. So Jesus is saying to us, look, don't be afraid of whatever is going to happen on this. Don't be afraid about those things. I am the great forerunner. I'm preparing a room for you, and you are going to be with me. And you know what's waiting for you there when we arrive with him? Love. A loving relationship with the eternal God of love. A loving relationship with all of God's children. You know, we'll be enveloped in that great movement, that great dance of love. Let me just conclude with the words from a hymn that we often sing called Bind Us Together. Bind us together, Lord, bind us together, with cords that cannot be broken. Bind us together, Lord, bind us together in love. There is only one God. There is only one King. There is only one body. That is why we sing. Fit for the glory of God, purchased by his precious blood, born with the right to be free. Jesus, the victory has won. We are the family of God. We are the promise divine. We are God's chosen desire. We are the glorious new wine. We are bound together forever, with cords that cannot be broken, bound together in love. The future kingdom will be a world of love. And let our prayer be that God speeds that day.